Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsail, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
The only real guarantee we have of freedom and dignity and respect within our society is if we come out.
My guest today is acclaimed actor, writer, and director Simon Callow. Since his stage debut in 1973, he's appeared in many films, including the hugely popular and beloved Four Weddings and a Funeral, and is well known for a series of one-man shows that have toured internationally. He's the author of several books, including Being an Actor, Love is Where It Falls, and a series on the life of Orson Welles. In 1999, he was awarded a CBE for services to acting. Simon, welcome.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
I am told that you spent some time in your youth in the country that I come from, South Africa, very much under apartheid. So tell us a little bit about what took you there and your experiences in South Africa.
I lived in Northern Rhodesia, as it then was. This is 59. And went to school in Grahamstown. It was a Jesuit college called St. Aidan's. And it was a very extraordinary experience because Northern Rhodesia was on the brink of independence. It was about to become Zambia. And relations between the black population and the white people were very easy and positive. I mean, everything was going very smoothly towards independence. So then one would take the train across the Victoria Falls, down through the Kalahari Desert, down the Boer War towns, past Cape Mountain and into Grahamstown, which is very much like a little English town in many ways, lots of churches and I think a cathedral as well, and never see a single black person at all. Because on the even on the railways, it was only Cape Coloureds who one would ever see. Apartheid was at its absolute most ruthless and ludicrous zenith. So the idea that you, even setting eyes on a black person could perhaps damage you. I mean, it was astonishing to me, having come from Northern Rhodesia, where the exact opposite was the case. So really, I can't tell you very much about my experience of apartheid in South Africa, except for never seeing a black person, which even as a nine-year-old I could see was completely insane and incomprehensible. And you would see, of course, signs saying "Niet Blankes" and all of these things on the, you know, stopping white people from going into certain places or stopping black people from going. It was like a sort of science fiction to me. It was a most peculiar in this unbelievably beautiful country. This, especially that Cape Coast, which is, as everybody knows, a glorious kind of Mediterranean climate, a heavenly, gorgeous place. And you never ever saw any of the actual native population of the country. You know? Astonishing.
So for what years were you in South Africa? You went at nine and you left when?
So I was 12. So I it was from 59 to 62.
And from 62 you went where?
England.
Okay.
Back to England, which
back
is where I had come from.
Now you had a sojourn. We'll circle back to South Africa, but you had a sojourn in Northern Ireland, and that you spent some time there, and that sort of shaped your politics. And
well, I went to Northern Ireland, to university in Northern Ireland, to Queen's University in Belfast. It happened to be the year of 1968, which was a sort of pretty interesting year for the whole world, and even in Northern Ireland things were stirring up, which hadn't been for a long time. And there was a movement called People's Democracy, which essentially existed to fight for equal rights for Catholics. And so without even thinking about it, one joined, of course. Well, I mean, I was a Catholic, as it happened, so I had a motive as well. But so I joined, and like almost all my contemporaries, we marched basically in favor of equal rights for Catholics. Of course, that meant marching against Ian Paisley and his faction. And when we marched, we were supervised by a group called the B Specials, who were a volunteer police force who were absolutely brutal. And I many a time had my shin thwacked by the black rods of the B Specials and harassed and shouted at. But in fact, we were in the ascendant at that time. The People's Democracy, for that brief moment, it was a tiny, tiny window of hope, I suppose you might call it, actually managed to call the shots. And we summoned the Minister of Education to come to the Students' Union and give an account of himself. And so we all piled into the Students' Union, and I remember the Minister of Education was a man called Captain Long, because everybody was a captain in Northern Ireland in those days, and he and his henchmen came into the hall, and somebody shouted out from the back of the hall, would Captain Long, as a mark of good faith, ask all the special branch men to leave the room? And he was a bit flummoxed by that, and he talked to his colleagues, and then he said, well, as a mark of good faith, I'm going to ask all the special branch men to leave the room. A third of the room emptied out. So we knew that we were in a charged situation. We had extraordinary orators, remarkable guys. It was almost like being in the Easter Rising or something. We had a really intoxicating feeling that we were going to make a difference, change things. Meanwhile, Paisley was muzzled. I think for a while I was there, he was actually in prison. But I actually saw him preaching in his church, and a more terrifying thing I've never seen in my life. It was like the Nuremberg rally. I mean, he was just sort of like a bull, a mad bull, raging and calling for the death of Catholics, you know, of whom, as I say, I was one. And then I went back home to my digs, and I said to the landlady that I'd you know, heard all this and how shocking it was, and he spoke about Catholic as scum and so on. And she said, "But he's not wrong, you know, he's not wrong." And I thought that I now see this is the... This is how bad and deep the problem is, that this very sweet, kind, funny woman actually subscribed to Paisley's conviction that Catholics were damned and evil and the source of all that was wrong in the world. I was 19 at the time, and so that was quite a startling introduction to the world of really hate politics, I suppose is what one would call it now.
And so that was a period of great activism. You also then started to begin a career in acting.
Yeah.
And how were, if at all, were the activism and the acting interrelated or connected?
Quite closely, because at that time, as it happens, Equity was a very politicized union. And there was a very strong Trotskyist faction known as the Workers' Revolutionary Party under the leadership of a very dubious man called Gerry Healy. But a number of very high-profile people like Vanessa Redgrave and her brother Corin were very prominent in the Workers' Revolutionary Party. They were very articulate their Trotskyan analysis was flawless, I'm sure. They basically staged a coup, or tried to stage a coup to take over the union. That failed, and I remember very vividly a meeting where the Shah of Persia had just fallen and the Ayatollah Khomeini had come to power. And Vanessa Redgrave stood up and she asked Equity, the union. It was a huge meeting of Equity from all over the country. It was 1,500 people. She asked us all to send a telegram congratulating the Ayatollah Khomeini on his marvelous achievements. And another actor stood up and said, I'd just like to read from today's Times, in which seven women have had their hands cut off in Iran for adultery and so on. So that it was our French Revolutionary period, really, but without the revolution ever quite happening. But I was very friendly with a lot of those WRP people, and it was an exhilarating kind of a debate. What they wanted, the WRP, was the nationalization of all theatres without compensation. So that would have been the West End gone completely, taken over by. But we all our debates were informed, or all our every production that we ever were involved in, and I did a lot of different kinds of things. I worked first at the Edinburgh Festival, then I worked in the Fringe in London, then I worked in the West End in London, and then I joined a company called Joint Stock, which was an avowedly political company, but not of any particular persuasion, but it was a left-wing, a radical company, do you know? And that was very common. I mean, most actors at some time or another belong to or were somehow engaged with a company like that. We did a play called Fan Shen, which was adapted from William Hinton's book by David Hare, the Cultural Revolution. We were all very great big fans of Chairman Mao at the time, embarrassingly now, in retrospect. But more specifically, I did a play for a company called Gay Sweatshop. That, in its own much smaller way, with a less universal kind of address, proved to be incredibly powerful. And it powerful for me, too, because I had no difficulty about being gay, and I'd been completely candid with everybody about being gay. But I thought the idea of a company written by gay people, for gay people, and about gay people was a little bit wanky. But then when I did a play, they asked me to do a play which I immediately thought rather marvellous, but had no idea how political it really was, in the sense that it was about two young men who had an affair together and then they broke up. Simple as that. Very simple, simple love story. But at no point do they ever talk about being gay. At no point do they talk about their mothers, or I don't even think Judy Garland was mentioned at any point. And so it was, in other words, a play which just took being gay as an absolutely normal part of life, and falling in love a normal part of gay life, and falling out of love a normal part of gay life. And when we played to our first audiences, who were, I think, 100% gay audiences, they were just shaken by it in a way that you wouldn't have thought that the play justified, except the point is they'd never seen gay people represented in that way before. So it was a very, very powerful thing to do, and a very extraordinary experience for me, and it sort of radicalized me a bit as a gay man as well, because I thought one could just sort of go on with one's life and not take part in any kind of struggle. I thought politics, gay politics, was all a bit boring. But then I saw that it's actually a very specific and has a huge impact on the lives, the daily lives of people, of gay people, always, you know, at all levels. And then I started marching in the old days, very different from the Gay Pride March of last weekend, where, you know, it was sort of like walking the plank. You didn't know what was going to happen. People, you know, anything could have happened. I mean, people could have beaten you up or so. But in fact, it wasn't like that, which was something that gave me a great deal of hope for progress in gay legislation and so on, was that, on the whole, the attitude to the march was extremely affectionate by the people who looked on. I never heard any aggression at all. I didn't even see any placards or anything. The police were absolutely relaxed about it and charming. I think these weren't the first marches, because these were in 74, 75, something like that. I think the very early ones might have been truly unnerving for the people who took part in them. But we had a feeling that there was change was in the offing, you know, without any question.
So Ian McKellen said on you, and I'm sure you've heard this quote before, there should be a statue to Simon Callow. He was the first, as far as I know, openly gay actor in the country, because he had grown up gay, he was gay at university, and when he became an actor, he was gay too. And when I read that, I was struck by the fact that in some ways, in 2019 today, at least in the West, large portions of the West, and I don't mean to minimize the constant and ever-present threat of homophobia, of hate crimes, of the ongoing challenge of HIV and AIDS. In some ways, this is a struggle which we've seen remarkable, remarkable progress in. And as I read that, I thought, my goodness, you know, the idea of even calling out and recognizing an actor for being gay in 2019 almost seems anachronistic.
Well, it's still true in Hollywood. I mean, you know, people's careers could be destroyed still. And the point is, actors find getting work pretty hard in any circumstances. And if you're going to be prejudiced, you know, you're going to be discriminated against by because of your sexuality, then you'll probably keep quiet about it. And to my regret, people like Rupert Everett and even Miriam Margolyes have said they wish they hadn't come out because they felt it had limited their careers. Or rather, what Miriam said was she wished she hadn't come out because it upset her mother so much just before she died. But I think that really can't be right. I think the only real guarantee we have of freedom and dignity and respect within our society is if we come out. I think it has to be. Of course, it was easier for me to say than for other people. Not that Ian isn't quite right in his sketch of my life up to that point, because I didn't grow up. I mean, I grew up knowing I was gay, but I didn't grow up saying I was gay. Not anyway to my family, certainly. I did at school. I didn't hesitate to say it at school, and I was never victimised. I've always believed, maybe innocently, but I've always believed that actually a great deal of homophobia is something which is whipped up. That on the whole, English people, I speak of English people because they're the ones I mostly know, English people rather like their gays. I mean, there's a as we can tell from all the openly gay performers around now, but in those days, even covert gay performers like Noel Coward and Ivan Novello, who never said they were gay, or even Danny Daru, who never said he was gay, had a huge following, which was quite specifically because they were gay, not despite their being gay. People liked it. They liked the fun and the flourish and the naughtiness of it all, I think they probably still do. It seems to me more and more so, but that doesn't mean to say that, as you imply, perpetual vigilance isn't required, because it is, as our society is suddenly fracturing at the moment in such alarming ways, people are always look for those who are other in any way, and then they it helps them to define themselves, and they feel stronger by denying the rights of other people who are held to be inferior in some way, whether they're Jewish or whether they're gay or they're black or they're something else, you know.
Tell us about the work of the Terence Higgins Trust, of which I know you're involved.
I'm sort of involved in the Terence Higgins. I can't pretend that I'm heavily involved. I've done whatever I can, you know, and contributed money and done galas and things like that, but I'm not actually involved. Ian McKellen is an amazing kind of inspiration, because the moment he decided, and after some hesitation and some anxiety, the moment he decided to come out, boy, was he ever out. And he's a natural spokesperson, I would say. I think he'd dislike me to describe him as a leader, although in fact in many ways I think he is, but he's a spokesperson. He's a natural. He's wonderfully good at articulating people's feelings and situations and so on. And it was a wonderful thing when he got knighted. He came out and then got knighted, and it immediately said it's no obstacle to your receiving an honour from. And astonishingly, a lot of gay people protested against Ian getting a knighthood or accepting it. They said it was because it was a Tory government actually that gave him the knighthood. But as he quite correctly pointed out, you don't get a knighthood from a political party; you get it from the country. I mean, that's the idea anyway. But he's been tireless and incredibly energetic and has contributed in every way to almost every aspect of gay life in this country, and I think he's a noble man for that, and for many other things too.
I want to come a little bit to your career as an actor, and I want to ask you a question about roles you choose, roles you inhabit. You could say some people choose roles because they love the character, they love the underlying story, they think they're technically challenging and choose them for that reason. What have been some of your favourite roles and why have you chosen them?
The role in passing by, the play I did for Gay Sweatshop, Toby he was called, was a wonderful part to play for all the reasons I've said. But it wasn't exactly a big character part, but it was just he was very open and funny and very gay, and it was delightful. And then again, a couple of the roles that I played, well, many of the roles that I really loved playing have been gay men. Obviously Gareth in Four Weddings and a Funeral was a wonderful part to play, for not only for the intrinsic pleasure of the words, the text, the character, the physical life of the man, but also because, again, at that time, and people often forget that Four Weddings and a Funeral came out right in the middle of the AIDS crisis, and it's about monogamy and commitment. And it's remarkable that Hugh Grant's character says at Gareth's funeral, we're all going around looking for that person, for the ideal marriage. We go from one wedding to another, that we never even noticed that right in the midst of us, our group of friends, there was a marriage. Of course, this line was long before there was gay marriage, a marriage, and that was the marriage between Gareth and Matthew. That is a really true marriage. And that I was very... The political aspect of Four Weddings and a Funeral, in that regard anyway, is not often spoken of, but it was very... I was very conscious of it, and again, go back to Ian, that he'd appeared in that film called Philadelphia, which was a terrible, weepy, you know, a big melodramatic thing, and he dropped me a card and he said, this film was done more for gay, the image of gayness or gay integration into society than Philadelphia and almost anything else, and I think that was absolutely true. Then I played, I did a play at the Bush Theatre called The Kiss of the Spider Woman, a two-hander with Mark Rylance, very young, indecently beautiful young Mark Rylance. And it was a phenomenal play. It is a phenomenal play. It's written by Manuel Puch, and it's just an absolutely extraordinary exploration of love. Quite remarkable, and just two of us in that little theatre, the Bush Theatre, for 3 weeks. That's as long as the run lasted. But I guarantee you, anybody who saw that production will never forget it, and I'll never forget it. Partly the joy of working with Mark, but the play itself just touched so marvellously right down the centre of what people, men, who love each other, mean to each other, men or women, but in this case, it's two men. And then I did another a character that I adored, which is in a play in English translation called Tuesday at Tesco's, and it's about a transgendered, or rather a transvestite in this case, a woman who goes back to visit her father every Tuesday and takes him out to Tesco's and has to endure the mockery and the contempt of her fellow shoppers, and it's a great play. The playwright, alas, is dead. He killed himself, not because it was his story in any way at all. I don't think he knew anybody even like that. He'd just seen a transvestite with her father in a supermarket and thought, what's that life all about? But it's a most wonderful play. I did it in Edinburgh and I did it in New York. And that's a case where I didn't play the character played me, you know. I just walked on stage and Pauline just took over, and it was wonderful. Apart from that, Sir John Falstaff is, I think, possibly the greatest character Shakespeare ever wrote, and I've played him twice, and once with the great pleasure of playing opposite Judy Dench as Mistress Quickly. And that was because Falstaff is an absolute reprobate. He's a disgraceful figure. He absolutely misbehaves in every way he possibly can. But he's just full of the life spirit. And there's no cant in him at all. There's no humbug. There's no pretense. He's just... lets it all hang out in a most extraordinary way. And through the two plays, from beginning of Henry IV, part one, right through to almost the end of the second play, you see him decline. You see his fire burning lower and finally guttering. But and it contains the most, possibly the most devastating scene that I know of in the whole of Shakespeare, which is when Henry V, or Hal, who now becomes Henry V, rejects Falstaff, who thinks that he's at his coronation. Falstaff thinks he's going to, of course, be made a great lord and whatever. And the king just turns on him and says, "I know thee not, old man." Only a genius could write that line then, you know. It's amazing.
I want to ask you a question on a tangent, and I think it's an impossible question for you to answer, but I suspect you'll have something interesting to say. And that is, you've played roles in which love between two men has been fully explored, at least as in an art form or in a literary form.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether you think, because of years of suppression this love being forbidden, whether in fact men love each other in ways that are profoundly different than men and women love each other, or whether in fact love is universal.
Well, I don't think the two propositions are mutually contradictory anyway. It's very hard to know, as I've never been a woman, how a woman really feels about love. I mean, I've read an awful lot about it, but quite a lot of that has been written by men, it must be said. But I clearly, there is a difference. If two people of the same sex are together, there are possibly problems to be negotiated, which don't exist between two people of opposite sexes, but then they have their own problems. And as I never tire of saying, there are as many different gay men, different kinds of gay men, as there are different kinds of human being. I mean, and we all have our... I mean, I've lived with quite a lot of people over my life, and, you know, with men, and they've all been utterly different, and all the relationships have been utterly different. So I don't know that there's any great conclusion that I could draw from it at all. And I don't even think that what is commonly said, you know, that there's always going to be a clash of wills between two men. I don't think that's true, actually, to be honest. And it's perfectly possible for there to be a clash of wills between women. I mean, I grew up among women, and only women, and I can tell you, horns were locked.
You're not just an actor, you're also an author, and you've written biographies of Oscar Wilde and Charles Laughton and Orson Welles. What took you into writing, as opposed to just being an actor?
Oh, I always wanted to write, but long before I wanted to act. My acting was a sort of accidental thing in my life, because I didn't know what to do with my life at all, like many people, and I wanted to write, but I couldn't. For some reason, it never crossed my mind to be a journalist. I don't really know why now, because I sort of am a journalist now. I write quite a lot for the papers. I review a lot, and so on. But somehow the image of journalism wasn't attractive to me, is all I can say. But I had no idea how. I loved the theatre and knew a lot about it and was there all the time. But I couldn't possibly see how I could be an actor, because there was no school drama in my schools, except in St. Aidan's, funnily enough. I've got a picture of me as an old gentleman shaking his fist at someone. But that's the only time I ever acted at all. Nothing in my secondary school at all. But I was endlessly going to the theatre, and then one day I got a job in a bookshop, which is not great, because it was a library wholesaler's. It wasn't even a bookshop. It was a, you know, you just moved romance novels around from one shelf to another. And one day I went to the Old Vic, and the National Theatre was in residence there, and Laurence Olivier was the boss. And it was absolutely... I suddenly realised that everybody working in that building, not just the actors or the directors or the stage managers, but the people in the bookshop, the people behind the coffee counter, the ushers, the house managers, all loved working there. There was a sense of everybody working towards the greater good of this organisation, and I thought it would be nice to work in an organisation like that, something from which you, as a member of the organisation, derived strength and pleasure and joy. And anyway, I sat down and I wrote Sir Laurence Olivier a 3 foolscap page, tightly closed, tightly typed, 3 foolscap page letter, explaining to him what a wonderful theatre he was running, and sent it off. I didn't say anything about I'd like to work here or anything like that, but he sent back a letter by return of post and said, if you like it so much, why don't you come and work here? We have a job in the box office. So I went and worked in the box office of the National Theatre, and then I just thought, oh, God, this is great. And then I started watching actors rehearsing, and then I thought, oh, well, maybe I met all these young actors called Michael Gambon and Derek Jacobi and so on, and I thought, well, they seem to be sort of ordinary sort of people in a way. They're not gods and goddesses. Maybe I could be. So I went to university in order to act. That was all. But I realised that I needed much more... help than they could offer me. So then I went to a drama school. But and it was not much later that I was asked by a friend if I'd give a talk about being an actor, you know. And I thought, well, that's boring. They would just want to know what it's like working with Paul Scofield or Felicity Kendall, which is, I mean, I can tell you, lovely. There's nothing more to be said about it than that. And then I thought, well... maybe I could use this talk to sort of sum up my views about the theatre and acting and all that. And I wrote such a long piece that I got through about the first 6 pages in my address, and there were still 40 pages left to read. And so somebody handed that on to a publisher who said, look, this is rather good. You could either edit a book with similar pieces from your contemporaries, or if you wanted to, you could write a book of your own, commission it. And so... he did, and that's my first book. It's called Being an Actor, and once I'd started, there was no stopping me.
So because we are constrained by time, I'd like to conclude with a question I ask everybody who comes on to this podcast, and which is, you've led an incredibly distinguished career, you've achieved great distinction, and a person who is starting their life early on their journey and wants to have a career in acting and needs to be warned about what lies ahead and also about the great promise that lies ahead, what would you tell him or her?
Well, I'm afraid the only thing I ever say to anybody in that situation is, unless you absolutely need to act, don't do it. It's not enough to want to act. You must need it. If you cannot get through your life without becoming an actor, only then must you do it, because you need something will sustain you through the extraordinary buffets and knocks and humiliations and feelings of rejection and disappointment and poverty that possibly lie ahead for you. And so I just, whatever it is, just look very hard into yourself and ask yourself, what is this need? Why do you need to act? What is it that you're trying to engage with? Not in order to dissuade you from it, but just connect to it and say, this is why I must do this. I have to do this. I feel that my life is worthless unless I become an actor, because that's the only way it'll work.
I'm not sure whether those are cautionary words or an exhortation to act, but it's a wonderful, wonderful note upon which to close. Thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.